This is Keith Scott Allen of Odeco.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
This episode of Herding Code is brought to you by JetBrains. The newer Sharper 6 from JetBrains has been available for early access for a while, but it was recently reinforced with support for Razor syntax. Also providing support for JavaScript and CSS, Razor 6 is destined to make Visual Studio a much better development environment. If you're using ASP.NET MVC 3 and want to use Sharper 6 for Razor coding assistance, try early builds of the productivity tool at jetbrains.net/resharper.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on January 5th, 2011. Tonight's guest is Sebastian Lambla. He is, according to his Twitter biography, a self-congratulatory, self-proclaimed, egotistical doofus. But we also know that he is a rather prolific figure in the open source world in .NET. He has a couple projects out there that he's been working on for a number of years, and that's what we wanted to talk to him about tonight. So, hello, Seb.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me on the show.
And I think we'll start off with what I think is your, most well-known project, which is Open Rasta.
Yeah, it's been going on for a while now, a couple of years, three years, something like that.
What's the 30-second overview of what this could do for me?
Open Rasta is a web framework with a difference. It's a framework that was built out of a lot of frustration that most .NET developers would understand if you worked on web forms for a few years. And it was all about how can we embrace HTTP a bit better without having to write loads and loads and loads of code. And so it was all the idea of how do we do composition-based programming, something that is nice to look at, something that has fluent APIs, and something that lets you do JSON, XML-based services and websites all together. So the main thing that Open Rasta does that very few frameworks did and still don't quite do in both the open source community and in the Microsoft corporate sphere, if you will, is that we provide exactly the same APIs for you to build web pages with nice HTML and to build XML and JSON services. And if you really want to do it right, to build REST architectures. So that's kind of the stuff that we built or that I built many years ago and that has been received quite well over the last couple of years.
Yeah, browsing through the documentation, it's interesting. You basically, there's three primary concepts, I guess, you have to get your head around: resources, handlers, and codecs.
Yes. Yeah, that's a bit different from most frameworks. And I wish I could allocate myself congratulations for the names, but sadly, I just copy them off the specifications that you get when you read things like RFCs, like the HTTP RFC or the standard documentation. It basically works a bit like an MVC framework with a big difference. In a typical MVC framework, at least on the ones that we have on the Microsoft platform, you have the controller that is going to receive the request and then do something and then decide to generate something that the client is going to show. And so you've got a controller that does that and it passes on to a view by passing in a model. And it's very, very much one-way oriented. It's very much, there's a request that comes in, you process something, and then you pass a model to the view to generate. And then, actually, MVC is not really three letters, it's four letters, because in most traditional frameworks out there, you have the model, you've got the controller that produces the model, and then you've got the view that renders it. But you also have the binder, and the binder is what receives the input. So you've got a view on one way for the output, for the stuff you're going to generate, and you've got a binder for the stuff that comes in. So really, when you talk about MVC, you're talking about four general components. In Open Rasta, we take a different view, which is that input and output should kind of be, as much as you can, symmetrical. So if you can pass the input, you should be able to generate the output. And so I went around with many different namings, and it seems that the thing that people understood the best was calling it a codec. So codec in Open Rasta is doing both the binding side of things, okay, receiving the request and passing that into an object that you can do something with, and writing back that object into HTML. It's providing a nice symmetry that, I suppose, for OCD-like personalities, for me, it looks much nicer architecturally.
I imagine if I'm writing something with Open Rasta and I want to produce and consume something in some new format, I'd probably just write a codec that implements an interface and it just plugs in somewhere?
Yeah, exactly. So in your Fluent API, when you define your resources, the resources being the thing that has a URL, right? If you've got something that has an internet address, that's called a resource, and that's about as simple as it gets. If you want to plug in a new format, be it that you want to read it or write it, then you just register a new codec. And in your Fluent API, you can do that, or you can do that by convention if you want to register it yourself. It's all basically two interfaces. Each of them has one method that takes two parameters, a stream and an output object. It's about as simple as you can make it without dumping it down too much.
How do you select the codec on any particular request?
Well, it depends. So it's a typical consultant answer, isn't it? So the it depends is OpenRaster was really built to try and provide a RESTful framework, so something that respects the rules of representational state transfer. I'm not going to go into the details of it because there's enough to do about 3 days of training on it. But fundamentally, you've got a thing that you want to access on a URI. And that thing may have multiple representations. One of them might be HTML, one of them might be JSON, one of them might be XML. If and only if, and that's the important bit, if and only if all of them are semantically equivalent, aka the client doesn't care about the distinction whatsoever, aka your browser will display exactly the same information to you if it's sent as XML or as HTML, we've got a feature in HTTP called content type negotiation. And that feature basically lets the browser or any user of your HTTP API respond, or rather emit the request by saying, I understand those formats. I understand XML and I like it very much. It's got a 0.9 of quality. If I want a 1.0 of quality, so I trust XML 90% and I trust JSON 100%, then that's content type negotiation. The client tells you, I understand JSON and XML, but I much prefer JSON if you can give it to me. And OpenRaster automatically does the content type negotiation for you. And so it's going to be able to see what the client wants and the format it understands and automatically select between all of those codecs and just use the one that is the most appropriate for that specific request. So we do that all transparently. You have literally absolutely nothing to do. It's all baked in. And so you can context switch very easily between XML and JSON on the same API without having any code to write, without having two methods, without having to have a huge amount of attributes all over the place, or without having to hack your way around it.
That's interesting. I always thought accept headers were kind of scary. Did you find yourself digging around through different browsers and seeing what they pass? And
yes, so there is. It's only scary if you talk about HTML. For everything else, the browser is quite useless anyway because you're going to do most of your requests through XML HTTP request or a framework that wraps it like jQuery, or you're just going to do it with a rich client or Silverlight and just call the request yourself. If you're a browser, then every single browser out there implements it quite all right, except for Internet Explorer, for a change. but even then, we have some specific bits in the codes that make sure that even with Internet Explorer, we don't have to hack away the code. So if you want a bit more details in that, it's quite simple, really. If your browser says that it supports HTML and everything. If you see an accept header that has */*, that means that the browser says, I am so good, I understand every single format on the planet, which Internet Explorer happily tells you. So if you see that, what we do on OpenRaster is that we basically downgrade */*. So if you tell us I understand everything, we accept that you may understand everything, but we prioritize everything that you actually specifically said, and we put the kind of wildcards at the bottom of it. So the net result is that in OpenRaster for the last 3 years, if you serve a page, an HTML page that's rendered by OpenRaster, it will be served as application XHTML for Firefox and Chrome and all the other modern browsers out there, maybe IE9, because they finally have support for it after 12 years of development. Well done to them. And for IE6, IE7, and IE8, we serve text/HTML. There's absolutely no problem there. It's an algorithm. Thankfully, in the last 3 years, the W3C has released a spec that basically formalizes the kind of algorithm we've had in OpenRaster for a while. So yeah, it is frightening. It doesn't work quite well, but with a bit of intelligence and guidance, you can actually get it to work in 99% of the cases.
Fascinating. I thought it was interesting, too, that it sounds like you can write the pieces you care about and then host them in different places or even load everything up inside of a unit test framework and exercise it.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because it's something that we built for OpenRaster Beta 2. And one of the main reasons was that, well, there was a couple of reasons. The first one was a purely, I suppose, feature-list-driven problem. WCF had the capacity of running in different environments. OpenRaster didn't. The second one was that by running OpenRaster on ASP.NET and the way it was tightly coupled before Beta 2, we had to suffer a lot of idiosyncrasies in the way that ASP.NET deals with HTTP requests. There's a lot of hidden code that does a lot of stuff before it even reaches you. And so there's a lot of stuff that you just can't do because the ASP.NET infrastructure has already taken away the request from you, passed it, put it on the hard drive, passed it to about five different bits before it gets to you. And by the point you get it, you just can't make any more decisions on it. So we rebuilt the whole of the hosting infrastructure. I think it was about a year and a half ago. Probably was a year and a half ago to 2 years ago. And we basically split off the core OpenRaster stuff and the hosting API. So right now you can take the same application that was built for OpenRaster 2 years ago and run it on ASP.NET or run it in process in a Windows service on top of HTTP listener. Or you can run it in an in-memory host that is going to literally just create a request in memory and get the response back in memory. And then you can do your unit test by literally writing a stream in and reading the stream out. And people are very, very, very keen on that. Now, it's especially interesting because a lot of new web frameworks that are happening right now, and there's about 20 billion of them at the moment, they all do fantastic stuff. And a lot of them are trying to implement some of this hosting API. So it's quite interesting to see, you know, many years later, I've not even touched that piece of the code for a long time, that, you know, a couple of years later, people are starting to see the value in doing that.
So I did have one thing to talk about with OpenRaster. One of the things that I kind of liked about it as it differs from ASP.NET MVC is the, I think they're called contributors and interceptors.
Yes.
And
yes.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and kind of explain what the difference is and how it kind of differs. Well, maybe not necessarily how it differs from overriding action result and doing all that jazz, but.
Okay, yes. So we have, I think we counted once because someone asked me to do a whole marketing blurb about OpenRaster and what it provides. I think we've got something like 30 extensibility points in the framework. There are each of the steps of the pipeline. By the end of the day, OpenRaster is a big pipeline engine. So the thing we do before a request comes in is that we build a big pipeline of, I think there's about 12 components out of the box that each do a little bit of the pipeline. So for the guys out there that know about Rails and Rack and all those infrastructures where you've got middleware components, we've got about the same equivalent and we've had for a long time called pipeline contributors. And ASP.NET, surprisingly enough, in all the designs that are a bit iffy that exist in ASP.NET, ASP.NET does have a pipeline model as well that is reasonably well designed as well. Now, the problem is you only know that if you decompile all the code because everything is internal and hidden away. But they do have a pipeline model. And the fundamental of the pipeline model is very simple. You've got each component is responsible for one stage of the processing. So component one takes the request, does a few modifications to it, then passes it on to component two, which passes it on to component three, all the way to the stuff that sends back the response to the client. And so one of the fundamental goals of OpenRaster was to be able for you to plug yourself in at any stage of the pipeline in a decoupled way. So if you know all the components you're going to have in your pipeline, like if you know the framework by heart and you know the 12 components that are already there and you want to add two more, then you could potentially in most frameworks just rewire them yourselves. Other web frameworks that are out there take that approach. You should know, because it's your application, that you will have 12 components and you want to add two. So now you've got 14 components to wire together. In OpenRaster, it's very, very different. We provide the pipeline contributors as we basically give you a guarantee that you're going to execute at some point. And the some point is defined as the stage of the HTTP pipeline where you registered yourself to be registered. So if you're going to say, I want to be registered between the beginning of the processing of a request and before the thing that actually starts pulling in the request body from an HTTP request, you're just doing your registration saying, please notify me before blah. And as soon as the request comes in, we're going to build that pipeline of all the components you registered, and that's in your debug output as soon as you run the app the first time. And we're going to let you choose or give you a reasonable guarantee of two places in between you can be executed, the beginning and the processing of the content, or between the result of the handler, which is the equivalent of the controller for the MVC fans out there, and writing the response. So you basically give two distances in the pipeline where you want to be executed, and we guarantee you that you'll be executed at some point in between those two, and no more guarantees. One of the features that is going to enable is when we get into OpenRaster 3 is that you can basically plug in a new piece of code that has no understanding or awareness of other pieces of code and be able to start modifying the request and provide features. So that's one level of extensibility we have. The other one is the Operation Interceptor, which is, to be honest, very much modeled after something that Jeremy Miller did in FUBU MVC very, very early on. I saw what they had as an API, and I thought that would be quite cool to have the same thing. So we built that in a day or two, and we just copied mostly what the API they had with a few changes. And this is kind of outside of the HTTP pipeline. So if you don't want to be down level and go and mess with the request and response yourself, you just want to literally know that the method is going to end up being called is going to be wrapped into a try-catch block. Or if you want to verify that the method you are calling is going to let you do it because it doesn't have a security attribute on it that says that you need to be logged in. If you purely care about functional execution of the code on the handler, then the Operation Interceptor gives you a nice method. You can wrap the actual code and you can register as many as you want platform-wide or per method and get that to intercept your request. And I think for those of you that may have had to deal with MVC before, I know I have quite a bit. I'm not sure what the state of MVC is. I don't need to use it anymore. But they used to have an action invoker, and the only way to be able to implement that kind of features application-wide was to basically replace the action invoker and redo the work yourself to make sure that you have that pluggability level. In OpenRaster, it's all baked in. And just like the pipeline contributors and the codecs and the handlers and everything else you use, everything goes through an IOC container. So if you don't like the API for registration in OpenRaster, just register stuff in your container yourself, and everything is going to be pulled out of it anyway. So it's really about, if you want to know really the difference between something like MVC and OpenRaster, is we run at core as a composition framework. We run at core by saying everything will be composed by some sort of container somewhere because we don't want the pain and we want to give you full flexibility to do it. Whereas in MVC, we are the MVC 3 stage and there's still static members and big interfaces to implement for those two or three or five specific places where the MVC team feels they can support you in extending their framework. We support it all the way, including replacing the whole of the pipeline if you don't like it.
I had another question, but just specific to MVC, I do know that is one thing in MVC 3 that they've got service location built in. So there is support for, I think, like 10 or 11 different places where you can inject things. But I think, as you're saying, it's built on top of ASP.NET. So there's still that kind of level of abstraction, whereas you've kind of stepped back a ways. And that feels more to me a little bit like what Glenn Block's doing with the WCF web APIs. And I think you kind of mentioned it in passing earlier, but I just wondered how you compare that. Like, for instance, it has that content negotiation and support for kind of the configuration where you say, I can respond to these different things and then it's negotiated and the response is sent out.
Yeah. So I will respond by telling you what Glenn told me when he took over the management of the WCF team. I've been involved with the WCF vNext team from the beginning, mm-hmm. Until they started talking purely about API. Then I thought it would be a bit strange for me to give them a help on the API, considering I'm building my own. So I helped them a lot on the HTTP side of things, went to meeting with them and everything. The only thing I asked Glenn was, don't make WCF as good as OpenRaster is. And he told me, but that's fine, because if I make it as good as OpenRaster, by the time I do it, your version of OpenRaster will be so much more advanced. So, I mean, they're doing great things. I have nothing bad to say about what they do. I have some implementation concerns about the fact that they are not interface-based. They're not composition-based, but I think they have to live in an environment where that I have the luxury not to have to live in. I can impose on people to live by the rules of a container and by the rules of design patterns. They don't. But they've done a great job. And if you look at the architecture of the new WCF, I think if you have experience in Open Rasta, you will feel reasonably at home. I mean, the whole architecture of reader writers are very similar to the formatters they have. The processes they have are very similar to the contributors we have. So I think at that stage, you know, the stuff they're going to release for the next version is good. I still think that we've got more features in Open Rasta that makes it an absolutely brilliant platform, but they've been going in a much better direction. And God knows I've been a very, very, very vocal opponent to WCF REST, the original framework, which was only RESTful by the name. They've done great work. Glenn has done great work. They are still very much focused, however, on the data side of things or the HTTP side of things. And that may have something to do that with the fact that the WCF team and the ASP.NET team are not exactly working together on this. And I think that's one of the main major differences is that a lot of the architecture in Open Rasta is due to the fact that we have to support both scenarios, whereas the work Glenn does is really, really good. But it doesn't have to take into account a lot of the stuff that is required to support ASP.NET, for example.
Yeah, it seems like, there's the WCF Web APIs is like it's designed for RESTful access to resources. And you could build a web application on it, but it's not really designed for that. And then ASP.NET MVC is built for building websites, and you could try and do RESTful access to resources, but it's not really designed for that. And so in an application using both, you'd probably end up using both of those if you were doing just Microsoft stack. And like you're saying with Open Rasta, you could do, it's designed for that whole spectrum. And
yeah,
which was clear looking at the documentation. You say, I can respond, to an HTML request using the ASPX view engine, or I can respond as JSON, or I can respond as XML.
Absolutely. I mean, not to throw stones at an ambulance or anything, but you have to wonder why, after so many years of HTTP, that distinction between the HTTP side of things and from the service side of things, and the HTTP side of things from the web side of things, still exists within Microsoft. For my life, I do not understand how those teams can continue existing individually. It makes no sense from the HTTP perspective. Now that the WCF would exist because of all the features it has outside of HTTP, I quite understand it. But the fact that there are still two frameworks on that platform, just for me, it just means that developers have to learn two different APIs, they have to learn two different ways of doing things, and they have to integrate two different technologies on the same site. And that's why Open Rasta was designed, is that there is no valid reason for that distinction to exist. The only valid reason for it to exist is that if you take only one or the other scenario, then you can bypass some things that you have to take into account when building those APIs, and it helps you focus on that. But I think the historical reasons for those two to exist is a sad accident of history. I really wish Microsoft would just merge those two teams and be done with it and say, we've got an HTTP team and they're good at doing HTTP. Right now, there's only one team that's good at doing HTTP. It's Glenn's team. And that's it.
Well, at one point, they had three ways to write a service. They had WCF, they had ASMX, and they had a HTTP handler. So I guess we're down to two now. That's good.
Yes, that's an evolution. But you know what? ASMX was not too bad compared to a lot of stuff that was built on top of it later. It was it was simple enough that it could be used.
I have to say, up until recently, any time that I used WCF instead of ASMX, halfway through I regretted it, because it solved complicated scenarios but didn't solve the simple ones. I'd end up in...
You wore out your angle bracket keys, didn't you?
Well, it's not just that. It's just I would try and do something that I would think would be simple, and it's like, oh, that's not supported. And I'd be like, how could that not be supported? Like, you can handle all this... all this other complex scenarios and enterprise scenarios, but I can't host my service on the same server as a client, in the same on unshared hosting basically, and things like that. So
I think you're absolutely right, but there's one point that's really important when you build frameworks like that, is that there's a distinction between three things. There's easy, there's simple, and there's intuitive. Now, easy is easy, that doesn't mean it's simple, because simple is not easy. Easy is the easy way to do it. I take one or two principles and I apply them to everything by introducing huge amount of abstractions. That's the WCF, the original WCF model. Huge amount of configurability and pluggability in a huge amount of complexity, just because we want to abstract in the same way SMTP and HTTP. Now, the people that built that, I'm sure, have their own reasons, but I'm sure everybody can account for the fact that it's certainly not simple. It might be easy, but it's not simple. Simplicity is, can I get to what I want to do in one or two steps? Now, it doesn't mean that those steps come intuitively. And I think that's the thing. You can say, I can go to the GEMS website and see that the command line to add a gem is blah. And that's simple, right? I mean, it goes and does a lot of complexity, takes it away from you by just writing one command line thing. But if that command line was named in a way that you don't recognize, you will never remember it, and you'll always have to go to the website to check it. When you look at intuitiveness, that's where you basically look at developers trying to use your stuff and say, what is it that made you block on that point? And then you try to remove that away or rename things heavily or make the whole system self-learning so that you give hints to people as what to do next. And I think those three things are very different. I think WCF fell on the simple and the intuitive. I think OpenRASTA, to a certain extent, reaches a lot of pleasure in the for developers on the intuitive part. Maybe on the simplicity part, we're not quite there yet. I think OpenRASTA 3 will be much better at that. But I think you have to take into account those three aspects when you design a framework. Is it easy from an architectural point of view to extend? Is it simple for developer to understand and reproduce and get quickly to the solution they want? And can they remember it next time without going back to the documentation? That's being intuitive.
Kevin?
Yeah, so OpenRASTA is really, as you've described it, a resource-oriented framework for the web. And I feel like the Rails guys are on the resource orientation bandwagon. They sort of get the RESTful stuff. But I feel like the .NET community hasn't had that much adoption in sort of, you know, a resource-oriented thinking. I'm curious whether you find that that mind shift is difficult for people, and does it affect, you know, how they use the framework or whether they use the framework?
Well, I think it does, and I think, but it's not limited to .NET people. I think on .NET we've had the issue of the last, what are we, with 2010, and I remember that people like Don Box and Clemens Vasters were talking about POX and REST in a very uneducated way. Some of them still do, but at the time they did it very loudly. That introduced a lot of confusion in the Microsoft community. Then the WCF REST framework came along, which was preventing you from enabling most of HTTP scenarios that are required in a nice REST architecture. I think all these things means that the vendor that is feeding the majority of the developers out there have introduced REST as some sort of glorified nice URIs on top of plain XML. And of course, REST is absolutely not about that. It's about identification of resource, uniform interface, and all the beauty that the web architecture provides. There's a lot of feature richness in there, where even IIS doesn't support all the features of HTTP yet, which enable a lot of scenarios in a RESTful architecture that you just can't get on a Microsoft platform right now. I think fundamentally it's not because developers on Microsoft platform don't adopt it. It's because they've been literally fed information that was inaccurate for so many years by people that are so recognized in the industry that eventually just people just adopted it, you know? And I'm very happy that the WCF REST team stopped calling themselves WCF REST and God knows what the name is now, but it's not called WCF REST anymore. And so I'm very happy with that, because they were not fundamentally RESTful. Glenn, when they built the web HTTP stuff, stayed well away from trying to brand anything REST, because REST is the easy way for uneducated people to talk about simple XML services. This is not what it is. It is not the richness of the web. It's completely wrong information that just gets developers confused. And I think you are absolutely right in saying that .NET developers maybe have been slower at adopting those architectures, but I don't think that we should blame developers. We should blame the vendor that has not been able to keep a certain level of accuracy when describing their frameworks and what they were doing. And sadly, they still do that with things like OData. So the kind of crazy marketing machine is still going, except now it's on OData. But I mean, At the same time, to be absolutely balanced, I try to be balanced. I know people think I'm a Microsoft basher all the time. I'm not. There's a lot of stuff I love in Microsoft. But the Rails guys don't get REST any better than the Microsoft guys. I mean, I've been talking to a lot of Ruby Rails guys that tell you that REST is about having actions on controllers called index. Because that's what the branding of RESTful routes on Rails is. Now, is it accurate? No. Is the implementation behind it okay? Yeah, it's okay. You can get on with it. It's not too bad. You can actually do something that can be RESTful. But just because you're using RESTful routes in Rails doesn't mean that you're going to be RESTful. So I think, you know, with all technology, you always have a vendor that's always predominant. And in Rails, it's the Rails team. With Microsoft, it's the Microsoft teams. When they introduce stuff by branding them in terms of architectural constraints, instead of just trying to find a new marketing name, then it slows adoption because people get confused. So I'm going to tell you about REST and what it is and the architectural constraints and all the things that exist in REST, like hyperlinks and forms and links and all this stuff. And I'm going to talk to you as an individual and then compare it to pages and pages of magazines and documentation that are going to tell you about REST as being nice URLs. You know, so I don't think developers are to blame. I think vendors, and it's across the board, are to blame.
When did you become passionate about REST? What opened your eyes to this?
I kind of started reading the. I know it's going to sound very sad, but I'm a very sad person. So there you go. But I started reading the HTTP spec. I think it was probably 2003, 2004. I was reading all the HTTP specifications that were going and all the RFCs and reading W3C stuff. I'm a big geek when it comes to standards. I kind of read a lot of mailing lists. And I was reading of all these things that you could do in HTTP. I was thinking, well, that's quite strange because all the stuff that we have on Microsoft platforms just doesn't seem to... Well, I didn't know any other platform at the time. So I was just looking at the stuff that we had. And I was a big web form developer. I loved web forms for a long time. And I was reading all this HTTP stuff. I was thinking, well, you know, there's a lot of cool stuff that we could do from this. A lot of really, really cool stuff. But it seems that there's absolutely nothing to actually do this at all. There's just, you can't define your own URIs, no concept of resources. You can't use any of the advanced features of HTTP. It just got me very frustrated. And it just kind of kept like that for a couple of years. And I just built, a couple of prototype blog engines like everybody does, I suppose. That's kind of... You know, there's two things you build in your life and stop doing. It's a blog engine and an ORM. And so I kind of did a few prototypes like that going, oh, you know, if we did HTTP right, it would be quite cool. I didn't really have the opportunity until one of my clients was very, very flexible in how I was driving the work in the team. And so I thought, you know what, maybe this time we'll just build the framework as we build the web app. And so that ran on a bigger sport company website for a while. We built the first version of Open Raster, which was called Raster at the time, because it wasn't open. I never got open. So I kind of built the framework because someone just, you know, gave me 2 months to hack together a first solution and say, right, if we go down to basics, is HTTP that complicated? Actually, it's not. We probably don't need all those abstractions on top of it. So that was around 2006, 2007. No, 2007, I think, or 8. I don't know. I'm very bad with dates. That includes both years and people. And so So we did that, and that was great. And then I wanted to make it an open source project. And so I shelled all the code and rewrote it completely so that I could actually release it in open source. And so that was the first version of Open Raster, which was 2008, I think, something like that.
Interesting. We had a question from Twitter from John Sheehan, who wondered if you would ever consider writing an Open Raster client.
So to answer his question, no, I'm not going to go onto the market of REST Sharp. He's got a great client framework. I mean, there's a lot of great client frameworks out there. You know, at the end of the day, HTTP is a very, very standard protocol. As long as you don't try to do weird things like, I don't know, view state or anything, then you can do great things with HTTP as it is. Now, there is a lot of property in the Open Raster code base, which would be quite interesting to bring on the client side of things. And OpenRAP brings in some of those prototype ideas. But is there going to be an Open Raster client in the next year? Probably not. There's just too much work with all the other frameworks. I mean, it's low priority. There may be an internal one that we use just so we can play with APIs until I settle on something and get an opinion on it. When I get an opinion on it and if it's good, then we'll release something. But before that, not really.
I think we could talk about HTTP all night, but I did want to talk about OpenWrap also, which is another one of your projects. But
can I shoot him one last question?
That, Kevin's going to force in a question.
Because
Kevin usually never talks until you're ready to wrap things up.
That's all right.
It's like, bam, 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 bam. Oh, there's Kevin's questions.
That's all right. I've got all night and 3/4 of a bottle of wine, so I'm okay.
So it seems like one of the areas where REST frameworks sometimes fall short is in that area of hypermedia, you know, linking resources with hypermedia constraints. And I'm curious whether OpenRasta does anything in that regard.
So we've had from the beginning a component called the URI resolver. One of the things that this thing does, so you pass it one of your resources, okay, the type that is equivalent to a model in an MVC, and it can go and generate URIs for you. So that was kind of a very entry level one, how to generate URIs. You can do that in your views and just use the extension methods that exist on objects. Or you can just go .createURI and the system will just go to OpenRasta saying, do you know this type? Yes. Do you have, you know, URI templates in there that match properties? Yes. Can I serialize those into the URI? Okay, so then I can generate a URI. So we've had that from the beginning. One of the things that REST frameworks recently have been moving towards to, mostly because of frameworks like RESTfully, has been around enriching hypermedia beyond just generating links. Now that's a more advanced topic and less people are usually implementing that kind of stuff, but this is something that Ian Robinson called hypermedia controls. I call them links and forms. So the two ways that you can navigate into a RESTful application is by following links or submitting things through forms. The form support we have in HTML already in OpenRasta that's implemented and has been implemented since version 2. One of the things that we don't necessarily have strong support around is things like typed links. So typed links are this idea that you've got a hyperlink that goes to a page, but you also have a relationship type that tells you what it is that it's actually doing. So to take an example that your listeners might understand a bit better, if you go to your blog engine and you want to go and edit a specific post, you know, you list all the posts you have in your blogging client, you want to click edit on one of them to be able to edit it, then you would have a relationship between the current page you're on and that thing as an editor, for example. So those are called typed links because they provide the link, okay, the destination to which you want to go when you want to edit something. And it also provides you with some machine understandable typing of that link, what it is that is the relationship between where I am and where I'm going. If I'm in a blog post and I want to go to the editor, then the link relationship will probably be an editor. Now that's the kind of stuff in OpenRasta where you have to build it yourself based on how you build your views. In OpenRasta 3, we may provide something that is closer to what frameworks like RESTfully does, but I don't want to go into... When you look at all these things, hypermedia is very, very application specific. What that means is that while the links themselves are very standard, link rel equal next or link rel equal no follow, we all know what they mean. They're standardized. The definitions are absolutely standardized. But they will absolutely be contextual to the thing you're currently building. So if you Google homepage, you're going to do link rel equal next very differently than if you are a dating website on the first page of the list of people that you selected to date next weekend, right? How you build those things are very, very contextual to building the actual representation, building the HTML page or the XML or the JSON page. So I don't want us to become too involved, because if you do, then you end up like RESTfully that basically does everything in the same way and generates too many things that I kind of feel are a bit too automated. But there's certainly some work that we can do in there. But to be honest with you, the reality is that there's so few people that actually build properly RESTful architectures. We can provide some defaults that make sense and try to automate that. For the rest, what I try to provide is a way for you to do it, but not enforce it on you, considering most of you guys will not be using it. So it's about not blocking if you want to do it, making the API simple to do it, but not necessarily provide defaults for everything, because then you end up with a very uniform way of the world where everything looks exactly like the same link relationships, and then you start processing them because you know they were generated by a framework rather than being just because they're part of the hypermedia document you have. So it's in terms of purely REST architectures, standardizing this stuff too much is actually counterproductive for designing your own own hypermedia-enabled documents.
I don't know if this is another rabbit hole to go down, but When you mentioned John Sheehan and REST Sharp, that reminded me of something that I discussed briefly with John, which was OData and his thoughts of OData being not really RESTful. And there were some things about it that he hated that when we looked at, he said, well, okay, I guess I don't mind that much. But I wondered if you had thoughts about OData.
Oh, yeah. There's plenty of things in OData that I hate with a passion. I actually gave a talk in NDC called All That Is Wrong with OData. So I think the videos are still online. I mean, the problem with OData is plural. One of them is that it's a data-oriented protocol. Now, RESTful architectures are not data-oriented. That's the first problem. Like, fundamentally, at the 101 level, I want to expose my database through the entity framework and provide a nice atom feed on top of it. That doesn't make it RESTful, right? It's exactly what I was talking about RESTfully earlier. If you start automating everything too much, then it all loses sense because you try to abstract too much. And when you try to abstract too much, then you end up with tooling, and you need the tooling. It's one of the things that is bad. The second thing that is absolutely horrendous in OData is the fact that they generate a whole bunch of URIs that you have to muck around yourself manually. And that, in terms of RESTful architecture, is a big no-no. One of the definitions of REST is that, to use semantics that are probably closer to developers, it's like late binding. You don't know in advance how to build the URIs. You kind of build them as you receive the instructions on how to build them. And so it's exactly like having late binding and early binding. OData is a protocol where you need to have early binding because you need to know how to build all those URIs before you can even, you know, request data. There is no way to, through a specification, be able to know, this is the form I need to fill in for my search. I'm going to send that and get results back. You can't do that with OData. It's just not part of the spec. Now, all these things we fed back to the original Astoria team, because OData is not a new invention. It's not new. It's not standard. It's not been created for the open web. It is just the protocol that was built for ASP, what is it called? ADO.NET Data Services. That's it. It's nothing else than that. It is the result of a product team that is part of the data div at Microsoft that wanted to expose web, databases as web services. So for what they had to do, they didn't do a bad job. Is it RESTful? Not necessarily. Is it data-oriented? Yes, absolutely. Do I like it? Absolutely not. It doesn't make the protocol RESTful. It's not nice to use. And my latest encounters with OData protocols is trying to explain to people that if you give me a URL with a bit of XML, I can pass that very quickly. If you give me an OData one that does paging and all this stuff, I now need to go and understand all the ways that you need to build all those URLs and provide all this knowledge inside my code, which means that every single time you're going to change anything in your protocol, I'm going to have to update. This is exactly what would have broken the web if we did that to start with, and RESTful architectures are about the web. Just imagine if 10 years ago someone said, you're not going to receive HTML forms for it, we're just going to give you in advance, when you build your browser version, that each of those web pages is going to get the data formatted in that way. And just imagine how the web would have evolved if we did that. It would have broken down after a year. OData is the same bag of pain, but now promoted as an open standard or an open protocol. I don't think they use the word standard, so I don't want to put word in their mouth that they don't have. But it's an open protocol as much as the Word 6 format is open, just because it's been documented doesn't mean it's open. It's certainly not RESTful, and it's not nice to work with. Now, I have an absolutely free conscience because I fed that back to the ADO.NET Data Services team when they created ADO, what was called Astoria at the time. I fed it back to the Astoria team more recently. I even did a presentation at NDC about it last year. So my lack of love for OData is very, very well known. Sorry, I don't want to sound negative because it always makes me sound terribly negative. There are a few ways that you can make OData much nicer. If you removed about a third of the spec and rebuilt it properly, OData would be okay. As it stands, it is not a RESTful protocol. And there is a reason why none of the documentation still specify that it's RESTful.
Just so I understand this, are you talking about all the operators that you can put in the URL to do like filtering and substring manipulation and all that?
Well, and that skip token for paging, I know that's painful, right? You mentioned that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the paging is painful. because of various things, but at least you've got some standardized way of knowing which page is the next one. But yes, the tokens and the URLs means that you need to know about URLs and you need to know about tokens. There is no way to late bind the construction to that, which means that the standard is taking a lot of the late binding of the web away from you and forcing you into using that. Now, if you ask anyone how to consume a OData service without a framework behind it, they'll tell you it's reasonably painful. If you ask anyone on how to build, and that's the most important thing, on how to build a OData feed without the OData frameworks they have, then it's such a world of pain that I know at least three people I have on my Twitter feed that tried and spent a fortune doing it for the only result of having a nice browser for demoware purposes in Visual Studio. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, you know. I can testify. I looked at building something along those lines too, and we gave up pretty early.
It's a shame. There was, you know, the intention was good. Using Atom was good. There's a whole bunch of stuff that was good in there. I'm not rubbishing the whole work they did, but they should have stopped when it was still reasonable. When they started trying to tightly couple link and URLs and OData, then basically they just killed it for themselves, really. And what is really infuriating is that this was the case 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and then it came out 2 years ago with all this marketing saying, look at what we just created. It's like, no, dude, it wasn't good back then. It's still not good. Why are you marketing that as an open thing? It's just, you know, it's a shame. It's really, it's a missed opportunity. That's how I would look at it.
All right, now that we've got you good and worked up, let's talk about OpenWrap.
Okay.
So tell everyone who's listening what OpenWrap is and what it can do for them.
Well, OpenWrap is a dependency manager. So the work OpenWrap tries to do is try to take away the complexities of dealing with all the bits that your application needs to be able to run. And when I say run, I mean build and run. So OpenWrap is there to make sure that there is a way for you to deploy JavaScript files to a web server or components to your system or maybe applications. Or maybe DLLs that you need when you're building a website, or maybe deploy your website on an ASP.NET app. All those scenarios are all exactly the same ones. They're only separated by the fact that they live in different technology spheres, but the problematic is exactly the same one. So what we try to do with OpenRasta is provide you with a platform in which you can deal with building, deploying, and composing applications at build time and at runtime, whatever the application, be it WPF, ASP.NET, you know, Windows services, whatever you want to put in there, and mesh all those bits together to produce an application and let you manage all those dependencies in a fashion that doesn't make you kill yourself, basically.
You're not talking about runtime resolution, right? You're talking about pre-compile time.
No. I'm talking about runtime resolution as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The main project I'm working on at the moment is rebuilding. I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to say, but we're rebuilding the whole software development practice around composing WPF applications in a very big financial institution. And one of the things that they do is that they've got multiple teams that work on different bits, and each of them have their own release cycles, and we have our own release cycles for the platform, and we've got a deployment on client machines as well. OpenWrap is not only providing the build time environment for people to take dependencies on components, we also use OpenWrap for the deployment on client machines. So we are not only replacing the add reference dialog, we're also replacing MSIs, and we're also replacing, you know, ASP.NET web deploy, whatever it's called. We're replacing the whole shebang with one framework. Again, it's the same principle as OpenWrap, as OpenRasta. There's a lot of different ways to do a lot of different things. They're fundamentally exactly the same one. So how about we just stop mucking around with 45 different technologies, just build one that works for everything.
Fascinating. Yeah, I didn't know about the deployment part of it. That's interesting. Because I always typically thought of it as, well, you know, I need nHibernate and I need Log4Net and all this stuff. OpenWrap will just bring all that stuff down for me and
yeah,
put
absolutely.
It in the right places.
I mean, that's definitely a scenario that we do focus on a lot, because most of our users that know about OpenWrap are developers. So certainly when you want to build Castle and hibernate and Elmer and whatever you want, then all these things need to be pushed together at build time, so you can press F5 and debug your application if you want to do that. Or if you're a bit more professional, you want to run your tests before you press F5, I don't know. You know, if you require as a developer an hibernate to run the application, chances are your users will require an hibernate as well. Why should they get the dependency differently from you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the fundamental of it. And if you look at other platforms, all the Unix platforms, there's package managers all over the place for deploying common applications. You get OpenOffice by going to an RPM package manager and pulling the packages.
Yeah, that's a good point. So the one question that would come up then is that we also now have NuGet. I think that's what it's called this week, right? NuGet?
I think they're stabilized on the name now.
Yeah, NuPack was copyrighted or something. It was something else where someone else was using it.
Yeah, it's apparently a DNA kind of protein analysis thing. But then again, you would have known that if you did a single Google search before releasing the name. I don't know. I always find funky names for my open source projects because the first thing I do is basically spend a night or two trying to find a name that Google doesn't have. And then after that, I start coding.
So for those who don't know, NuGet is advertised as the free open source developer-focused package management system for the .NET platform. But NuGet comes from Microsoft. And I think there was some community discussion about when this came out after OpenWrap had been announced. I mean, how did you feel about all that? Or, you know, what sort of feedback have you given that team? I know OpenWrap is consuming NuGet feeds, so it appears like they're sort of working together.
Well, I'm not sure we're working together as much as I'm working towards compatibility with them. I'm not too sure where I stand on this. To be honest with you, the people that are following me on Twitter know that OpenWrap has been now in work for a year. It's been 12 months since I started working on it. We did a whole lot of work and a whole lot of prototypes to find out what it was that we wanted to build. And so we released the first code job in May. From what I understand, the NuGet guys, which was called NuPack at the time, did that in formed their team in April. Now, the only thing I can tell you is that I got aware of NuPack at the end of August. And that by that point, we had 8 months of development behind OpenWrap and a lot of experience behind building it. The NuPack guys went to the team that was building NuProj, which were doing great things with Ruby, and got them on board by getting them to drop their code base and join the one Microsoft built. It didn't make any sense for us after 8 months of development to just look at what Microsoft has been building for, you know, all these months behind closed doors and say, hey, let's just, you know, drop off all the efforts that we put into our architecture and adopt yours and cheer you. So I think to a certain extent at the beginning, there was a bit of a shock for most of the developers that were working on it, wondering why it is that, you know, for 5 months things happen without us knowing about it and then being presented with something that apparently was 2 weeks away from being a beta. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, we have very different platforms and there's a lot of design decisions that are very, very different because of how we build stuff. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not happy with how things went. I'm not particularly happy with that team and how they managed us or mismanaged us or didn't talk to us more specifically. But at the end of the day, it's a very positive experience because there are packages out there and that's the most important thing. I mean, you know, you're going to choose OpenWrap because it has a feature set that does a whole bunch of things that are very different from what NuGet guys do. What is important is that the packages are there, right? So we can consume NuGet packages and we can import that into your system. And there are 200. See, I can go and say there are 206 or 306 packages available in OpenWrap. Yeah, because we consume the NuGet ones and ours as well. So that's great. That's very positive. And it's certainly helping everyone that there is some work done from Microsoft that pushes packages to exist. Now, if you ask me my personal ideal of what could have been, I would have loved for the guys to come over when we were building OpenWrap saying, we plan on doing that. We'll put you on an NDA. Do you want to work with us before you invest too much time in it? This is not how they decided to deal with it. It's sad. But, I mean, it's good for diversity. I'm happy that, you know, we are providing two different views on how things are being built and how you should build an application. And you know, in the end, will I get an MSDN Tribune to talk about OpenWrap? Probably not. But, you know, if I get the same amount of usage as from OpenRasta, we'll have absolutely amazing thing to build in the next couple of months. And that's really brilliant. So it's a kind of a bittersweet for me, really. That's kind of where I stand.
Yeah, you get the benefit of all those packages out there. And I guess the difference in viewpoints would be that NuGet is really focused on a Visual Studio experience, or at least a build time experience. They offer the PowerShell command line, where OpenWrap is really about truly being a package management system.
Yeah.
You know, to go further with that, but there's the PowerShell, but I think even that is considered like the power user way of using it, because you can also right-click on a project and you get a little dialogue. So, I mean, just to extend what you're saying, K-Scott, is that it really does seem focused on your inside Visual Studio. You want to add something into your project. How can we make that as simple as possible?
Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you know, that's what they do. It's dev diff. They're there to sell Visual Studio, right? So it's perfectly right. Understandable that they make the IDE GUI experience as good as they can do it. I think that the fundamental design decisions that are behind a lot of things like versioning and all the things where I've had very large discussions with the NuGet people on their website has been around the fact that we are trying to cover a lot more scenarios than what they do. So maybe, I suppose if you look at the package management environment, where you've got NuGet, which is really focused on Visual Studio and has a nice UI and everything, us, which have system-wide packages that you can deploy to use tools and everything, we've got no dependency on anything, so you can run us on Unix without having to have any kind of PowerShell crazy stuff going on. And the co-op guys, which are doing non.NET, C++, pull the source and build stuff and deploy it on the platform, I suppose OpenWrap would be in between those two systems in terms of how deeply we integrate and how prescriptive we are in how things should be built.
So OpenRasta has a bunch of really good documentation with it. I was searching around and didn't find a huge amount about OpenWrap. Is there some place that's a good place to go to learn more about it?
Yeah, well, we try to document everything that is usable in the wiki on the GitHub website. So right now it's all on the wiki. It's going to be published on the OpenWrap website soon. We've got a small tool that is going to publish all this wiki automatically to the website. So most of the stuff is already in the documentation. It just doesn't have a nice table of topics. Yeah, we don't have the nice presentation for it yet, but the documentation is there. I mean, there's enough information from the wiki for you to do anything that I feel comfortable publishing right now. There's plenty of features that are in there that I just don't talk about yet, because they may change a bit in the next... I can't really say, but until we release, which is going to be very, very soon, with V1. So, yeah, you've got that. And then because we're very command line oriented, we've got a full help system as well. So when you're on the command line and you don't know what to do, you've got the get help command. If you know PowerShell, our shell works exactly like PowerShell. So you will feel just right at home. It works exactly like PowerShell. Get-help will give you all the help from all the commands you can get. Get-help with the name of the command. It will give you the information, the parameter information, everything you need to know how to use all the commands. So, I mean, it's reasonably well documented. You can get away with a lot of it without needing to go to the wiki. If you go to the wiki, it's because you want to know about versioning or package dependencies or all the advanced features like the system repository, the command system, integrating with MS Build, building packages, publishing packages, all the stuff that we support that basically lets you be so much more productive than other systems out there. Most of it is documented already.
You know, I think that, like, going back to what you were saying at the beginning of this, that this is great because you've got kind of this similar in a way to, like, you know, when there's Entity Framework and Hibernate, and you've got, you know, something like there are a lot of people that just won't look at anything until it shows up in Visual Studio, and there's a lot of shops that aren't going to allow developers to use things until it's kind of shipped in the product. But then once people start using things, like, people are going to expect dependency management tools to just become standard, and that's just how you do things, you know. And then you've got additional features that go further. So it seems like, you know, a good thing for the ecosystem.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, at the same time, it's about the same thing as the Entity Framework and an Hibernate conversation. You know, it's all about the long tail, or rather, it's all about not the long tail. Okay, the system we're building with OpenWrap is something that lets you do a huge amount of productivity. I can create a new package, you know, add a bunch of projects, build a package and publish it, all that in three command. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of productivity we're looking at. Now, is it for everyone? No. A lot of people are afraid of the command line. They don't want to learn how to use the tool. And we understand that. But at the end of the day, you've got the 20% early adopters and the 80% of the rest of the people that will decide to jump on the bandwagon when they do. And the amount of resources that you need to be able to cover those 80% that just don't want anything that you can't point and click is the reason for, you know, data sources and the entity framework and design surfaces and all this stuff to exist. They're not productive. So at the end of the day, when I'm building stuff, I'm really looking at how can I enable scenarios that are common for the 20% early adopters, the people that really want to be productive, quick, efficient, and just get on with it with the job. And I'd rather provide something that is as productive as Rails rather than provide something that just looks nice like the rest of Visual Studio.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doesn't mean we don't.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't mean we don't have a UI. We've got people working on a UI. We'll have a fantastic UI that will probably be published for 1.1 in February. We'll have a UI that integrated with Visual Studio and all the shebang just because it's one of those, you know, checkbox features. I originally proposed to the NuGet guys that maybe when they do their UI, they should make it multiple package managers aware, but they decided to not respond. But that's certainly something we're looking at, try to bring in this UI into Visual Studio so that we can help out for the kind of, not necessarily the whole 80% of the long tail, but maybe for the 5% that are in between, just to get them hooked up fairly quickly and be able to navigate and browse stuff. So this is all being worked on, and we're going to have something there. It's not the main focus, though, because what I really want to be able to provide is a way to deploy this stuff in an easy fashion and in an intuitive fashion where you can write a few command lines at the command in your favorite CLI and just, you know, get on with the job. Just not care too much about clicking around too much or trying to drag and drop stuff. And I think the from experience, because we've built this stuff with, you know, developers that are using it day in and day out. OpenWrap itself is built with OpenWrap and deployed with OpenWrap. So any kind of edge corner and pain we have, we feel every single day because I work on OpenWrap continuously. And I work on the components we do at work continuously based on OpenWrap. If something breaks, we know it very quickly. If something is painful, we remove the pain as quickly as we can because, you know, let's put it that way. If you build a package manager that doesn't use a package manager for deployment, I think you have an issue. It's like if you're going to provide a deployment platform for developers, you'd better be able to deploy your own stuff through it. And we do, and it's fantastic dog fooding. It's providing you with so much incentive to provide more productivity and make something nicer.
What's the flow for using OpenWrap in an application?
Okay, so you really have two different workflows. The first one is for existing applications that you already have, and the second one is for new stuff that you want to build. The typical workflow for new project is that you just call the initwrap command, and that's going to generate for you a default descriptor that contains all the information about your package and what it's going to require, and copy a folder structure for you, create a source folder for you, and put all this stuff in it. Coming up in a couple of versions is template support, so you'll be able to just create your project and at the same time generate a bunch of templates so that basically you write one command and you've got all your templates for tests and for your core projects and everything just all ready for you to start hacking away. Now you go, the second step is you go in Visual Studio, you create your projects, you save them into the right folder or in another folder if you don't like that folder. And you just enable OpenWrap on those projects. There's a command called initwrap, but you do a dash all, and that basically scans all your projects inside your folder structure and automatically hooks up OpenWrap to the build process. So we actually inject ourselves within the build rather than just try and go and add and remove references ourselves. This gives us a lot more flexibility in how we can influence packaging stuff. Once you're done, basically you're done. So if you want to add a dependency on something, you're going to go through the UI and go and add an hibernate, or you go and do add wrap and hibernate in the command line. That will just work. And then automatically, as soon as you type the command, Visual Studio will recognize it. If you've got ReSharper will be automatically updated in real time. No need to update references, no need to touch Visual Studio. There's no needed Visual Studio code. It just updates the descriptor, okay, the list of packages you need. And we automatically hook ourselves into ReSharper as well. So you automatically see your solution going from red to green as soon as the package is added for a type that you implemented. So it's all very, very dynamic and very, very quick. And it's absolutely not integrated with Visual Studio. So if you use Notepad or if you use Mono Develop or Sharp Develop or whatever it is that you use, it will still work exactly the same way and it will work out of the box. There's no mucking around with your project files. So you can pull in all the dependencies you want with that. And because we inject ourselves with a build process, creating a package out of the stuff you just did is literally just a matter of calling the build wrap command. It will automatically call all the projects that you have and it will detect all the stuff that is in the output of the projects you're building. So we can take all the DLLs that you have built from your projects, build them automatically into a package, and we put them automatically into a package that has the right name, and we generate a version for you and everything. So it's build wrap, goes, compile all your solution, detect what was built, put it into an iZip file, name it the right way. And then when you're done with that, if you want to publish it onto a remote repository, you simply go and do publish wrap, and you say which repository you want to publish it in. And then the package will be sent and published automatically. And so maybe I can reveal a small secret we've been talking about with another team. Do you know the symbolsource.org website? It's basically a website that provides a symbol server for open source projects on Microsoft platforms. A symbol server, for those of you that don't know what it is a server that lets you configure Visual Studio by saying, this is a symbol server. If you need, because you don't know about that binary, if you need to go and download the PDBs and the debug symbols and the source code for me to be able to debug into that library. So you're trying to debug Castle Windsor 2.1, let's say. And you're trying to step into the code. Naturally, if you don't have the PDB files and you don't have access to the source files, Visual Studio will just tell you there's private code and just break into debugging mode and show you no code at all. If you have a symbol server configured in that knows about those DLLs, then those will be automatically downloaded from the server as well as the source code and everything. So you'll be able to step in into any DLL that you ever referenced, even if they're not installed, even if you don't have access to the source code or the original binaries. So that's something that's coming up in OpenWrap as well very, very soon. You'll be able to basically build your open source project and automatically push not only the binaries to the OpenWrap servers so that other people can use them, just so they can add them to their Visual Studio project, but we also have automatic publication of the PDBs and the source files straight to symbolsource.org, and they'll store them. And as soon as you configure that in Visual Studio, you'll be able to debug. Basically, you'll be able to publish all this information automatically to them, and you'll be able to break into and debug into any projects that went through that process. It's really about taking all those bits that you could have done in .NET but were very difficult or painful or slow or complicated and making that as easy as we can. And if basically it takes more than a command, one command, then I start moaning about it and we rewrite it.
That's really cool. I've used the Microsoft Symbol Servers before, but I didn't know about symbolsource.org, so that's cool.
There you go. You'll be able to get exactly the same results from any open source project that uses OpenWrap as their package format, which I hope will be all of them, obviously.
Who runs that Symbol Source?
That's a very good question. I know it's a couple of guys, but I don't know. I think the guy's called Marcin, or the guy I was talking to was called Marcin, and they're trying to do a lot of work around that, including having software as a services for companies and stuff.
Wow.
But yeah, if you go to symbolsource.org, they already have a couple of binaries in there. But it's really about how do we bring the technology they build and the stuff we're doing into a one command line to be able to have the equivalent of the Microsoft symbol servers or the Microsoft source servers and be able to debug into any open source framework or any, for that matter, commercial software that wants to be published on that the same easy way that you get from Microsoft. Because right now it doesn't seem like Microsoft will provide the resources to do that kind of stuff. But the Symbol Source guys are doing it, and I think that's a great effort to support.
I looked it up. Okay, so Marcin, I'm going to mispronounce his name if I try and say it. MikolaJczak.
That's right.
There it is.
Wow, neat.
Mikolajczak? I don't know. I can't pronounce that. I tried at least.
Cool.
I tried.
Yeah, it's a very cool thing.
All right, I think we've exceeded an hour. Should we about wrapping up?
Well, we got to talk about Owen at some point, too.
Mm. Yeah, we can open wrap it up. Yeah, we can talk about Owen if you want, yeah.
Tell us about Owen.
So Owen is an effort that was driven a couple of weeks ago, I think. I'm not sure who triggered the effort, but the idea was to say, well, you know, for a long time there was only ASP.NET and Monorail, and then there was Fubu MVC and OpenRaster. And since then, I think we have about 200 gazillion different web frameworks that are out there. And one of the things that personally has infuriated me a lot in seeing those web frameworks develop is the amount of work that is involved in making very trivial things work. And frankly, there is absolutely no competitive advantage or even interest in rebuilding HTTP stacks continuously. I mean, it's boring work. There's nothing interesting in it. And unless you're an RFC geek like me, it really, really has absolutely no benefits whatsoever. The only thing you end up with is 40 frameworks that implement half of the spec and most of them wrong. And so you end up with making standardization much more difficult. The other part of it was being able to provide some features that are going to be available on FUBU means they won't be available on OpenRaster, which means they won't be available on ASP.NET, which means they won't be available on Kayak and all the new frameworks, Manos and all the new frameworks out there. So the original intent was to say, well, how about we just specify a very, very simple way to standardize on how we process HTTP requests so that you can build your application against what originally was a very simple interface. It was an I application, an I request, an I response. And then if everybody does that, then building a new part of an application or building a bit that enables, I don't know, authentication through OpenID is literally just a matter of implementing that interface, and you'll be able to run it on OpenRaster if you want, or on FUBU, or on Kayak, or on anything that supports Erwin. And Erwin was that. So the name, I think when I proposed it, was called Open Web Interfaces for .NET. I think it sounded quite good. So that was the original intent of the interfaces, to provide a rack equivalent or WSGI equivalent. Was it WCGI? I can never remember. Equivalent to say, how about we have a standard way of calling into applications, and then the whole reliance on ASP.NET can just be done and over with, and we can just ditch the whole of the granny platform. So a lot of people just got involved, and a lot of hacking has been going on, including by Glenn Block, so on, with a bunch of prototypes on web HTTP and everything. And first spec was built. There's now new specifications. I've kind of had to withdraw slightly from it because there's a lot of churning going on in the mailing list. But I think it's a great effort of people trying to say, you know, we're not going to be able to generate a completely new platform with all the variety and all the excitement that exists on other platforms unless we start taking the problem of standardizing multi-vendor in our own hands. The reality is we are not in a multi-vendor platform. We're not, and our vendor doesn't necessarily have much interest in making it multi-vendor, which is understandable to their shareholders. But this is something that we need for the community to be able to drive really innovation at the same speed and the same scope that all the platforms enjoy. So this is kind of the effort. How do we decouple ourselves from hosting environments? How do we make things pluggable, and how do we foster a whole ecosystem to be running off one or two delegate signatures? And I think the benefits to code ratio is absolutely massive on this project, really. So I'm really, really supporting Erwin.
All your projects seem to have O or open at the beginning of them. So nice to see that.
Yeah, well, that is true. But I think, for the name, I think the mailing list is called .NET HTTP Abstractions or something like that. And we had a discussion about how to call the interface. I think I proposed that one because obviously I had open in the name, and as you've noticed, I kind of like keeping the open prefix. I think it's quite descriptive of the way I work. And the domain name was available, so I registered it, and then I sent an email saying, hey, I registered that. It sounds good. Do you like it? And then I think everybody just liked it. So it's all a mastermind plan to take over any piece of marketing that contains the word open in it.
One of the implementations is Frac that's in F#. That's kind of
neat. True. Yeah, there's Frac, and at some point there was a framework called Crack as well. Which was in C#. I think it's been renamed now. But I thought the name was absolutely brilliant.
All right, Seb, this has been a fantastic conversation.
Okay, hang on one sec.
I knew it.
I'm just kidding.
This has been an intriguing conversation with you. In the show notes, we'll have links to all your GitHub repositories for the source code here and your wikis and so forth. You're on Twitter as Serial Seb. You're on codebetter.com as a blogger. What else would you like people to know? Do you have anything exciting coming up? Any presentations?
Well, we're going to be doing a lot of OpenWrap and OpenRaster combined work and WPF and all that in great presentation that's coming up at KubeCon London. So if you are in London, come and see us. It's going to be fun. Apparently, Glenn Blogg is going to be heckling me from the audience. So that should be fun. Otherwise, you know, I'm on Twitter, and I don't bite as badly as I sound when I'm on Twitter. So come and talk to me. I love talking with people, especially if they tell me that they've got a better idea than mine. Then I'll steal it and implement it.
All right. Thank you for being on the show.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thanks, everybody, for tuning in and listening. We'll see you on the next episode of Herding Code.